case, and more specifically, a bomb threat. The plaintiff in this case, Mr. Zwick, claims that his wife, who was seen as a patient by Dr. Skinner and other providers, had a sore or a lesion on her heel all of the short period of time when this condition should have been followed closely or by biopsy done earlier. The case went to trial, and after both sides presented expert witnesses, the jury found against all Kaiser and Mayor. We have several issues on the field. I probably won't talk about all of them today. One has to do with the admission of a nurse's testimony. Other issues pertain to the claim against the Health Maintenance Organization and other services.
My name is Ben Sachs, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Lloyd Zwick. Lloyd Zwick was in the trial court as both the personal representative of the estate of his wife, Judith Zwick, and also he was appearing individually. And that's because he had both wrongful death claims and survivorship claims. As Betsy mentioned, that the claims were brought against Dr. Genereau, a primary care physician, and also against Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. And the claim against Kaiser Foundation Health Plan was essentially based on the negligence of a physician's assistant named Rebecca Arnold, whose name you may hear. The plaintiff alleged that the defendants provide negligent care and treatment for a non-human being. This is the result of his death on July 24th. The non-human wound is documented in Mrs. Wick's Kaiser medical records to have been present from at least January of 2010 until January of 2011, when it was finally biopsied and diagnosed as melanoma. The plaintiff claimed that because of the negligence of defendants, Mrs. Wick's melanoma was not diagnosed sooner, but would have been curable, and that Mrs. negligence resulted in certain non-economic damages to Mr. Wick. Now, after the trial, the jury returned a verdict in favor of the plaintiff and against Dr. General and Kaiser. The jury found that Dr. General was 65% at fault, and Kaiser was 35% responsible. The jury awarded the plaintiff total damages in the sum of $9,329,600. The trial court then entered judgment on the verdict, but then later entered an amended judgment, and that's because under Colorado law there are certain statutory caps on damages. And applying those caps, the court later entered judgment $734,000 or so against Dr. Genereau and $74,000 or so against Kaiser after applying the damage caps and the jury's findings of pro-rata liability, and also offsetting and deducting certain amounts that Kaiser had paid for Mrs. Wick's medical expenses.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. Ms. Moran?
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elizabeth Moran, registration number 16119, appearing with my co-counsel, Mr. Conklin and Ms. Cardona, on behalf of Dr. Genereau, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. As the court knows, we have raised several issues on appeal, and in the time I have today, I am probably not going to get to each one of them, but I would like to focus on three issues I think that had the most critical impact on the case. And if I may, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, the first issue I would like to talk about has to do with the admission of Nurse Dumas's testimony regarding the standard of care for his physician, namely Dr. Genereau. The other two issues that I'll talk about are related issues concerning claims against Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, the first being the vicarious liability claim for the alleged conduct of Rebecca Aronoff, the physician's assistant who saw the patient in 2008. And the second being a direct negligence claim against the health plan for failing to enforce or to ensure that Ms. Aronoff followed a melanoma screening guideline that was contained in Kaiser's clinical library that concerned the performance of a full body skin examination. So first things first is I'd like to talk about Nurse Dumas's opinion testimony. Admitting her testimony, purporting to state the standard of care for a primary care physician like Dr. Genera was a critical error. It went to a core issue of the case, the very central issue of the case, the issue of Dr. Genera's negligence in or alleged negligence in his treatment of Mrs. Wick. Admission of this testimony violated CRS Section 1364.401. It was an abuse of discretion to admit this testimony because that statute sets forth the legal standard for the admissibility of expert opinions in medical negligence cases against a physician and provides that no person shall be qualified to testify to the standard of care for a physician in a negligence case unless that person is a licensed physician.
Ms. Moran, let me ask, is a motion in limine enough to preserve an evidentiary objection, or do you have to make a contemporaneous objection at trial when that evidence is offered?
In this case, there was a motion in limine made. I believe that preserved the objection. There were also specific objections made when the issue of Nurse Dumas's testimony was brought up for the first time at trial, which was right before the testimony of plaintiff's expert, Dr. Gidey, who was, as the court knows, the conduit initially for bringing in Nurse Dumas.
Let me also ask at this point, if I may, regarding Nurse Dumas, would her testimony have been acceptable to you if she was offered as an expert in standards of care attributable to or for nurses generally?
Were the standard of care for a nurse, a wound care nurse such as she, at issue in the case, but there were no issues regarding the standard for a wound care nurse. She is qualified to testify to nursing standards, but not to physician standards.
But here the physician, Dr. Gidey, was asked questions regarding statements that Nurse Dumas had made, and her testimony, if it didn't adopt those statements, certainly opined about the correctness of them, did it not?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. But I don't think that that makes a difference to the jury's hearing of a nurse's standard of care opinions. True, this was initially brought in by plaintiff's counsel, reading verbatim from Nurse Dumas's deposition, her statements, Dr. Gidey agreeing with them, but what the jury heard was Nurse Dumas's opinions, identified as being Nurse Dumas's opinions about what a primary care physician should have been, and all of these were directed at the care of Dr. Genero.
And she also testified at trial.
Yes, she was called to testify by the plaintiffs 2 days later at trial.
And although you objected to certain of her in-trial testimony, that's not a part of the appeal here.
That was part, by that time her testimony was water under the bridge. It was objected to, and then when that testimony was allowed in nonetheless on cross-examination, defense counsel attempted to, you know, explain the circumstances and limitations on her testimony, that she was testifying from the perspective of a wound care nurse at a different time than Dr. Genero had been treating the patient and so forth. By that time, the evidence had already come in 2 days earlier.
Does it matter, for example, if we had a statement from plaintiff's counsel saying, do you agree with the following standard of care? And then quoting from Nurse Dumas' deposition, would anything be wrong with that?
Without identifying her as a
yes.
If that is presented as an abstract statement that presumably some physician would agree with or some physician would say the same thing, that would be one thing, and that might have been acceptable.
Well,
I'm not sure in the context of this case it would depend entirely on presentation, but the nurse's opinions can't be admitted against the doctor.
So is the only difference here that Dr. Gidey wasn't shown a text and ask if that's, if she considered that to be an authoritative source? Because if that had happened, just that simple question, then you wouldn't have any problem with any of her testimony, would you?
The difference with that hypothetical, Your Honor, is that is an authoritative source. A nurse's opinion testimony about a doctor by law under the statute is not an authoritative source. It's not admissible.
Even if that standard was considered by the doctor to be absolutely on all fours with an authoritative source and on all fours with the doctor's standard of care.
Your Honor, it's one thing for the doctor to testify based on things she learns or things she reads or things she hears that something is the standard of care and she agrees with that. The damage that was done in this case was to admit these as the opinions of a nurse. And I'd like to talk about the prejudice that this had. Not only was this another standard of care witness for the plaintiff, an unqualified one, but this allowed the plaintiff to develop a theme which was reiterated several times during the trial and repeatedly in closing arguments, that was this. Even a nurse who hasn't been to medical school knows the standard of care for a primary care physician that Dr. Genereau didn't know. Four times in closing arguments, at least, plaintiffs referred specifically to Nurse Dumas's opinions about timing of a biopsy, when you should change treatments, how you should document certain things, how you should take the patient's history, and then culminated in the argument, even a nurse who hasn't been to medical school knew the standard of care and Dr. Genereau did not. That flies in the face of Section 1364.401. It's reversible error. It violated Dr. Genereau's substantive right under the statute to have his negligence, the question of his negligence, determined based on the testimony of licensed physicians.
Ms. Moran, does it matter that there was another defendant here, namely Kaiser? And I should think that if any of the issues involving Kaiser's employees were alleged to be negligent, that the nurse could at least testify to what the wound care people should have been doing.
There were no issues raised in the case concerning that period of time when Ms. Wick had been referred to the wound care clinic, which was later in her course. There were issues much, much earlier, 2 years earlier, with respect to Nurse Aronoff, but that was a completely different set of circumstances. So there was no call for any testimony about nursing standards of care with respect to the wound care that Nurse Dumas or any other wound care nurses performed. So that was, there would be no basis to admit that testimony because it was not an issue in the case. So I would like to move on and talk briefly about the claims against Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. The first is the vicarious liability claim. Again, this goes to the conduct of nurse or of physician assistant Aronoff, who saw the patient in 2008, a year and a half before Dr. Genereau saw the patient. She was seeing the patient for a scaly lesion on her face. And at that time, she performed an upper body skin examination and dealt with the lesion on the face. But according to Dr. Gidey, she should have performed a full body, head to toe skin examination. Dr. Blum, the plaintiff's oncologist, said that had that been done, what was later diagnosed as a melanoma would have been visible at that time as either a raised or a discolored area. But there was no expert testimony from Dr. Blum or Dr. Gidey or anyone else about if Ms. Aronoff had performed this full body exam, if she had seen this area that was either raised or discolored. What then would have been required, and would that have led to an earlier diagnosis? There was no testimony that had she done this and had she seen this, a biopsy was required. There was no testimony that had she seen this, a referral would have been required.
And is it your position that that had to be presented via expert testimony as opposed to Ms. Aronoff simply saying, if I had seen this, I would have done X?
It did need to be expert testimony because the determination of what diagnostic steps to take is a matter of clinical judgment, and that requires expert testimony. So this is a critical issue of causation, and without this causal link, the claim can't go to the jury. Now, the jury couldn't infer this for themselves because it can't be said that every raised or discolored area needs to be biopsied. Anybody in this courtroom probably has half a dozen things that could be described as raised or discolored, but they don't all need biopsies. Nor could the jury infer from the fact that 2 years later, Dr. Gaudet said that a biopsy was needed when Dr. Jenner saw the patient. At that point in time, this was an open wound, it was non-healing, it was red, it was swollen, it was tender, different set of circumstances. So without this causal link, the issue could not be submitted to the jury, and it should not have been. Directed verdict should have been granted. Now, the direct negligence claim is related. It's the claim that Kaiser was negligent itself in failing to enforce this screening guideline that called for a full body skin examination when one is doing a screen for melanoma. That claim has the same defect, the same lack of causation evidence, that had this been seen, that something, standard of care would have required something to be done that would have led to an earlier diagnosis. The second defect with this claim is that there was no evidence at all of the standard of care applicable to Kaiser Foundation Health Plan as a health maintenance organization. Like the blood bank in the Quintana case, or the hospital in the Trag versus Centennial Peaks case, the standard of care for an institutional healthcare entity has to be established by expert testimony.
All right, is it your position that the guideline that's under discussion was not evidence of a standard of care that Kaiser thought ought to be implemented?
I think the Trag case addresses that point. First of all, it's a guideline. It was in Kaiser's clinical library. It was not a policy and procedure that was distributed and, you know, that everyone was notified about. It was a resource in the library. And the second thing is, in the Trans case, the court said, you know, the fact that the hospital in that case didn't follow its own policy doesn't obviate the need for expert testimony to establish the standard of care and breach of that standard by the hospital. Same situation here. There was no expert testimony about what a reasonable health maintenance organization, which actually cannot even practice medicine, what's the standard of care for an HMO in enforcing certain clinical guidelines for all of its providers to follow.
Doesn't the statement you just made obviate the need for it? If a health maintenance organization cannot practice medicine, why is there a need for an expert standard of care?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of your
question. If a health maintenance organization cannot practice medicine, which is what you just said, why do you need a standard of care for an expert standard of care created by a medical physician?
It would be an administrative standard of care. It can't. I mean, that's kind of the dichotomy here, is that how can a health maintenance organization tell its providers how to use their clinical judgment? That's one problem with the claim. And the other problem is that even if they could, there's no evidence of the standard of care that would govern the HMO in doing that.
But Ms. Moran, isn't that the whole underpinning of respondeat superior? If you have a standard of care that is incumbent upon the employee, and the employee violates the standard of care, then the boss is responsible.
Yes, Your Honor, that's there's a distinction here between the vicarious liability or respondeat superior claim and the direct negligence claim. They are not the same. The standard of care that has to be proven for the direct negligence claim is the standard of care for Kaiser. The standard of care for a vicarious liability claim is the standard of care of the employee, whether that be Ms. Aronoff.
But didn't they get an instruction here on respondeat superior?
Yes, there was, because both of these claims were submitted to the jury, and so there was an instruction on respondeat superior and an instruction on HMO negligence that talked about a reasonable HMO, but there was no evidence of what a reasonable HMO was required to do. And I see my time has elapsed. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but if not, I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Sachs. I represent Dwight Zwick individually and as personal representative of the estate of his wife, his late wife, Judith Zwick. To begin with, I'd like to address a question that was raised by Judge Graham with regard to the standard of review and whether or not a motion in limine will suffice in lieu of a contemporaneous objection. As we indicated at footnote 7 of our brief, when a trial court is presented with a motion in limine and denies the motion in limine without prejudice, leaving it up to the moving party to renew that objection during trial, normally this court and the Supreme Court will not view that as preserving the issue. And so we would disagree respectfully with Ms. Moran that was enough to preserve it just simply by filing a motion in limine when Judge Eliff refused to rule because he felt that the motion was premature and he wanted to hear more of the evidence. So the next question that I wanted to comment on is Judge Graham, you mentioned whether or not statements were of Ms. Dumas were properly attributable to. I'm sorry. You raised the question about Ms. Dumas' statements, and before I get into the questions that you asked directly, I want to remind the court of something that's very important, and that is that during the trial, it was defense counsel during cross-examination that specifically elicited testimony from Ms. Dumas, who then was the head of the wound care department at Kaiser, asking her about questions or asking her about statements that she had made during her deposition. So normally when this court has held that when a party opens the door to testimony, that the court is not required to review a claimed error when the party injected that error into the trial. So our contention is that simply by going into it, and there was extensive direct cross and re-examination of Ms. Dumas, which included questions about her statements made during her deposition, to the extent that defense counsel specifically went into that and opened the door to those questions, and we pointed out the specific questions in our brief and cited to the testimony on June 21st, 2013, and specifically asked questions about what normally should occur when a wound is acutely present for 4 to 6 weeks, and the statements that Ms. Dumas had made during her deposition, we would respectfully submit that it's not appropriate or necessary for this court to review that as potential error.
Mr. Sachs, does it matter that her testimony occurred after Dr. Gaudet testified?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, because that was done during the plaintiff's case in chief, and the plaintiff did call Ms. Dumas, and it was a strategic decision that was made by defense counsel to elicit that testimony from Ms. Dumas. If they wished to preserve that error, then they shouldn't have opened the door.
Counsel, regardless of whether of your invited error point, I'm looking at page 578 in the transcript, and it appears that Mr. Conklin asked to have a standing objection to the line of questioning of Dr. Gaudet regarding the nurse's opinions. Wouldn't that suffice to preserve the issue, notwithstanding the fact that they didn't renew their motion in limine?
Your Honor, respectfully, we think not, because once the defendants made a strategic decision to open the door and go through it and elicit that testimony, that evidence was before the jury by virtue of defense counsel's questioning. So simply, asking to preserve that objection wouldn't suffice. They injected that issue affirmatively into this case.
And do you also agree with Ms. Moran that the testimony of the nurse bore solely on the negligence claims against the doctor and not on those claims against Kaiser?
No, actually, we don't. We believe that, first of all, I think it's important to bear in mind that even the defense medical experts acknowledged that there was substantial overlap in the standard of care between a primary care physician such as Dr. Genero and also nurses, advanced practice nurses and other nurses who evaluate and treat suspicious skin lesions. There was also testimony of Dr. Gaudet on the same point. So to the extent that there were also claims against Kaiser based on nursing negligence, that testimony was relevant and it was admissible, and the court was perfectly free to overrule the objection because, to the extent that that testimony was not solely related to the standard of care applicable to Dr. Genero. But I want to go further, and that is Dr. Gaudet provided expert testimony regarding the applicable standard of care of a primary care physician. I think that the question was raised appropriately. Would it have made any difference if the question had not made an attribution specifically to Dusty Dumas and her statements during her deposition before trial, but it just simply made the naked statement and asked whether or not Dr. Gaudet agreed? And for all practical purposes, there wouldn't have been any difference. Dr. Gaudet was not basing her opinion on Dusty Dumas's testimony. Dusty Dumas was an allied healthcare professional who had been involved in the care and treatment of Ms. Wick. And as part of her responsibilities in the case, Dr. Gaudet reviewed a whole host of different statements and deposition transcripts and records and other evidence informing her opinions in this case and giving her expert testimony. And certainly it was appropriate for her to base her opinions on information that was contained in Ms. Dumas's deposition stating what the accepted practices at Kaiser were. So she simply was stating that the standard of care applicable to a primary care physician such as Dr. Genero were perfectly consistent with the statements made by Ms. Dumas.
Well, Mr. Sachs, the rule says that the deposition of a party can be used for any purpose. Are you suggesting that because she was an employee of Kaiser that her deposition was the same as if she were a party?
No, sir, but she was, during the examination, cross-examination, and re-examination of Ms. Dumas, she was asked questions about statements that she had made. And to the extent that she gave somewhat inconsistent statements, the prior deposition statements were admissible both for purposes of impeachment and as substantive evidence under Rule 801. So they were admissible on that basis. I also wanted to address the issue of causation with regard to Ms. Aronoff. As the court is aware, this court is bound by the jury's findings and can disturb those findings only if those findings are clearly erroneous. The jury specifically determined that Ms. Aronoff and Kaiser specifically through Ms. Aronoff was a cause of the injuries and death of Ms. Wick. Now, the law in Colorado with regard to causation has been stated in several cases, including the Supreme Court's decision in Graven, and the court said that where, as here, an injury results from the combined negligence of the defendant and other factors, the injury is attributable to the defendant if the injury would not have occurred in the absence of the defendant's negligence. So in this particular case, there was ample evidence of causation in fact. There's absolutely no issue of legal causation in this case. The only issue that was raised in the directed verdict motion had to do with causation in fact. And Ms. Aronoff was specifically asked questions concerning her agreement or disagreement with various statements. Among the statements to which Ms. Aronoff agreed, which are recounted on page 29 of our brief and are part of her testimony on June 21st, 2013, she was asked if she agreed that if a lesion is not recognizable as benign, it's necessary to biopsy it, and she agreed. Did she agree that biopsy should be done when in doubt? If she sees a lesion as not recognizable as benign, then let the pathologist determine whether it's benign or malignant. She agreed. And she agreed with the statement that the gold standard for diagnosis of skin malignancies is a tissue biopsy. Further, the jury heard testimony that she took a biopsy on August 18, 2008 of a concerning lesion on Ms. Wick's face. So the jury certainly could have drawn the inference based on Ms. Aronoff's testimony, as well as what she actually did in 2008, that if she had completed a full body examination, as she was required to under the applicable standard of care, that she would have seen a raised discolored lesion, and it would have been biopsied, leading to detection and appropriate treatment at a time when there's very little doubt that it was curable. So the jury it had ample evidence, and its finding on the causation in fact issue was not erroneous. So this court should not be disturbing the jury's findings, which are based on sufficient evidence. In the remaining time, I did want to reach the last issue, which has to do with costs, if I may. This actually presents a novel issue in Colorado that we believe was not addressed by this court's published decision in the Chandler McPhail versus Duffy case. First of all, we believe that the issue that's presented is one of waiver. If you look at Judge Loeb's opinion in Chandler McPhail versus Duffy, he actually frames the issue in terms of a waiver, and he says that when Dr. Duffy filed a bill of costs, the plaintiff asserted that Duffy had waived the right to recover litigation expenses. So he identifies it as an issue of waiver. Waiver under Rule 8C of the Rules of Civil Procedure is among the list of affirmative defenses that must be raised or else it's waived. So Colorado law recognizes that if an affirmative defense such as waiver is not raised, then you can actually waive waiver implicitly. And that's what we contend happened here. But that's not all. The court didn't just simply find that the defense had not been timely raised. It also focused on Rule 16, which governs TMOs, and also found that the issue had not been raised in a trial management order, and therefore, it was not appropriately raised in a timely manner by the defendant, and therefore, the issue of waiver based on a contractual pre-litigation agreement that was claimed by the defendants. Would not appropriately be considered on merits.
Well, Mr. Sachs, despite your invitation to decide a novel issue on the question of waiver, even if we were to determine that it's not an affirmative defense that has to be raised, isn't it enough that the trial court, in its discretion, decided under Rule 16 that it wasn't going to allow the EOCs?
Yes, we believe that both under Rule 8C and under Rule 16, or either one, the court could simply on that basis decline to reach the issue. We think that the plaintiff was clearly entitled to a cost award under Rule 54D and also pursuant to Colorado Statute 1316.104, which mandates an award of costs to a prevailing plaintiff. A prevailing plaintiff is one who succeeds on a significant issue in the litigation. There's no question that The plaintiff met that test. And we would ask, in conclusion, that the court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeal, or affirm the judgment of Judge Eliff, and also specifically affirm the cost order, the award of costs to Mr. Zwick. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. We'd like to invite counsel, if you have the time.